For the third episode of the Game On podcast, we are grateful to have with us Bailey Moody. Bailey is completing her master's in clinical health counseling after completing her bachelor's in psychology. Bailey is a five-time national champion with the Alabama women's wheelchair basketball team, including being the MVP in 2025's national championship. Bailey is a bronze and silver Paralympian on Team USA. Bailey is a sibling to four, and a daughter to her mom, Tiffany, and a daughter to her dad, Patrick. Bailey, thank you for joining us today. We are so grateful to have you.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Thank you so much. Now, Bailey, start us from the beginning. Tell us about your family and your childhood growing up. Because you lived a very active household.
I did. Both my parents are college athletes. So my dad, he played baseball at the Citadel, and then my mom played soccer at Auburn. So two parents that know what it looks like to play in college and know what that grind looks like, raising kids that also were literally super active and super willing to try new things. I was a very active kid. I basically tried every sport under the sun, like you name it, I tried it. But basketball was just something I kept coming back to. I loved it. I've been playing since kindergarten in some sort of rec league or some sort of something. So that's like probably 16 to 18 years of playing basketball. So definitely was my love. It's funny because my parents, both all of my siblings have played or do play some sort of sport. And it's funny because my parents are like, we couldn't get anybody to play our sports. Like none of them play baseball or soccer, but I think they're just happy that we're out there and being active.
Tell us about your siblings. So where do you fall over the course of your siblings in terms of the order?
So I'm the oldest of four. My youngest sister she's 11 right now. So it's me and then a brother who's 21 and then a sister who's 18 and another brother who's 16 and my 11-year-old sister.
That is so cool. What is it like being the oldest of a big family?
Oh, I love it. I almost wish I had more siblings. Like I love my siblings. We have a really great relationship. They're my best friends. And I like having a big family. It's really, really great.
Now you're growing up outside of Atlanta. Atlanta's obviously that's the geographic point that everyone thinks about. If you're from Georgia, how far are you from Atlanta? That's normally the question. Like, but you're from Alpharetta.
Yes.
Alpharetta, Georgia. Yep. What's that area like?
It's a suburb of Atlanta. So Alpharetta and Johns Creek joined to just be, so it used to be all of Johns Creek and Alpharetta were just Alpharetta. Now technically we're Johns Creek, but it's the same thing. It's like 80,000 people, so it's a pretty big suburb.
Yeah.
That's basically where I've lived my whole life.
That is great. It's a good community.
It's a great community. We've been going to the same church. Basically my parents were there before I was born, so I was basically born in that church and then went my whole life all the way through going to college. So it's the same community, and which is nice because you're building that and you have that your whole life. So to grow up around people that are basically family as well is really special.
It is. Now, your first 10 years of life, for the most part, were pretty normal. Pretty normal as a normal kid. But then when you were 10, you started to feel knee pain. Can you walk us through what that process was like and when you started feeling that pain?
Yeah, at 10, I was in the fourth grade. I was playing all kinds of sports. So that weekend that my parents ended up taking me to the doctor to get scans, I had played a doubleheader softball match, played a tennis match. I had played some basketball games. So we thought, oh, this is just some sort of injury or growing pains, overuse. Cancer wasn't in the cards at all. I had developed over the course of about 6 weeks some pretty severe what we thought was swelling in my knee. And my parents, with the help of my aunt, who's a physical therapist, were like, okay, maybe this is more than just an injury. We need to take this in. And so after about 6 weeks of pain and it waking me up in the middle of the night, we went in for an x-ray and an MRI and a biopsy, which then ended up in a diagnosis of bone cancer. And that was over the course of, like, the pain started, about 6 weeks went by. As soon as I had those scans, there was about 4 days until I started chemo. So it all kind of happened really, really quickly.
So your life got turned on its head just like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my life changed in a matter of 4 days. And as a 10-year-old, you don't, old people get cancer. You don't really understand that young people can get cancer too. So I truly had no idea what I was in for or what was going on.
So you were diagnosed with osteosarcoma, which is a pretty rare bone cancer, especially in pediatrics. Now, you said you started chemo 4 days after learning about that diagnosis. Being a kid, obviously you said, you know, cancer, nobody thinks that their child is ever going to have cancer. How did your parents process that news and help you understand it as a 10-year-old?
Yeah, my parents they always gave me the information up front. They gave me the information that I could handle, but they didn't ever lie to me. They basically were like, you're old enough for us to make you aware of what's going on. So they always used terms with me like cancer, like chemo, like they explained everything up front to me. They allowed me to be able to develop my own opinions and thoughts about it, but they also, you know, my parents instilled this hope and this resilience in me of, we're going to do this and we're going to do it together and we're going to get through it. And so even though I don't think I had expectations going into it, other than this is really scary and I don't know what's coming next, I think they did a really good job at then stepping into that gap with me and guiding me through it in a way that my 10-year-old head could understand, but also in a very truthful and authentic way, which I really appreciate looking back on it now as an adult, of having that information and not feeling like anything was ever being hidden from me, because it was my body and because it was something that it was so intense and heavy. But my parents did a really good job at helping me navigate that. Really,
they even included you in the decision about whether to have surgery, to amputate, whether to have a full knee reconstruction, or whether to have the surgery you ended up having, which was the radiculoplasty. Mm-hmm. So what went into that decision? Because that was a monumental decision that's really changed the course of your life up to this point.
Absolutely. It's the biggest decision I've ever made.
Yes.
And, you know, with childhood cancer, with osteosarcoma specifically, they have to go in and they have to take the tumor out. It's not like this, oh, we'll only do chemotherapy and see if it goes away. It's like, we're going to do this much chemotherapy, we're going to do surgery to take out the tumor, and then we're going to do more chemotherapy. So you really only have, between when I started with chemotherapy and when I had surgery, it was like 4 months. So you really do not have very much time to make this decision. So my parents had done all the research on the front end. My dad had flown all over the country talking to surgeons. So they had developed this idea of those three choices. So it was an above the knee amputation, basically a limb salvage, which is basically a knee replacement, and then a rotationplasty. And my mom came to me basically and said, here are your options, and presented it in the most unbiased way she possibly could. Here are your options. Here's what it would look like with each of these things. We want to leave this up to you. And I looked at her and I was like, you're crazy. I want a rotationplasty. It's the only way that I can play sports again in the way that I want to.
I want to play basketball.
I said, I want to play basketball again. How do I do that? And that's literally the only thing that my 10-year-old head was thinking, was how do I get back to basketball, which I think is a blessing and a protection. But I still say it was the easiest decision I ever made. And really? I often wonder, if my parents and I were on different pages, what would have happened? Good thing is they were on the same page as me and they were letting me come to that decision, but they had already decided, you know, this was the one that we would really like to go with. Good thing is that lined up with what I wanted to.
When you get that diagnosis, you go from being a full-time kid to a full-time fighter. How did you work through that chemo? And over that long, several month span of those treatments, probably not being in school much, not seeing your friends, not playing basketball. How was that for you?
It's definitely something that you take one day at a time. And it's definitely something, every day I would wake up and I didn't know how I was going to feel that day, just because of how all over the place that was. And I was basically had some sort of chemo round almost every week. And so I was in the hospital like three quarters of every month or something. And so, yeah, I missed my friends. I was a full-time cancer fighter. I didn't really get to go to school that much. I was taken out of that community, and my closest friends were doctors and nurses for a time.
I felt the same way. PT too.
Yeah, my your PTs, yeah.
Like the people I saw the most were my PTs and the techs.
Yeah, yeah. And that's just like such an abrupt change for a kid to have to go through. And
you become an adult pretty fast.
You do. You become an adult very, very fast. You learn how to talk to people very, very fast.
Definitely.
Too. And it was just a one day at a time, one step at a time type thing in this fight, for sure.
And did you undergo PT afterwards?
I did a ton of physical therapy, yeah. I did a little bit while I was in chemo, but I had my surgery about halfway through my chemo, but then they can't get you up on a prosthesis until after chemo ends, just because the chemotherapy slows down your healing. So I really couldn't, my bones couldn't fuse or anything while I was still in treatment. So I didn't really start intensive physical therapy until post chemo treatments. I did a little bit just to start building muscle and stuff, but I couldn't do a lot of weight bearing physical therapy until after I was done with treatment.
How long did it take you to regain your strength?
Probably from the end of chemo, about a full year of like full time physical therapy, 2 to 3 days a week. And then after that, I started to feel like I was in like a pretty good spot and feeling good in my sports and able to keep up.
So that happened in fourth grade. And then you continue to play stand-up basketball.
I did.
Up till seventh grade.
I did.
So you just, they couldn't stop you. They couldn't stop, like, did anybody ever say, hey, look this way? Or did you know that adaptive sports was an option? Or was it just like, hey, I have my prosthetic. I can still play basketball. I can still shoot. Mm-hmm. Lights out. Let me play with my friends.
I wanted to play with my friends. I wanted to play for my school. Yes. I wanted to be able to be the kid that I was before cancer. And, you know, I didn't really want anything to be adapted for me.
I
the whole goal all the time in practice was to not come in last. And I did that a lot. But it got to this point in seventh grade specifically where people were getting faster and I just was working so hard to keep up that it just wasn't fun anymore. And yeah, sure, I could keep up. Basketball's tough. Volleyball, it was super easy to keep up. I could have kept playing all the way through high school if I wanted to. But basketball, with how quick the game is and how much changing direction and lateral movement there is, it was tough. And I was losing the love of the game because I was just focused so much on getting up and down the floor. And so that's when my parents kind of started to look into the adapted athletics option. And that's where wheelchair basketball came into the picture. And I basically got in a chair and loved it and fell in love and never looked back. And I was like, I can go fast again. I still get to play the sport that I love, but the playing field is level. And I don't feel like I'm working so hard that I'm not loving it anymore.
I've been thinking about this recently, ever since you got into college, and you start thinking about the internship and the job searches that happen as you grow through the ranks of college. As a high schooler and as a middle schooler, all the way through elementary school, you want to be like everyone else. Mm-hmm. But when you're looking for jobs, mm-hmm. and you're in college, you want to be as different as you can be. I think if only we didn't feel that pressure when we were young to feel like we had to blend in. When we're in life, we really are supposed to stand out. I just think that's it. I wish I knew that earlier.
I totally agree. Yeah.
I wish I knew that earlier, that you don't have to be like everyone else. Authenticity sells. And authenticity is something that can't be replaced. If you are authentic in your job, in your profession, in who you are, that's somebody that people are going to want to be around.
That's
true. Don't have to be like everyone else. Just an aside.
That's true.
For wheelchair basketball, who introduced you to it? And what was your first experience playing on a wheelchair basketball team?
Yeah, so my dad actually hunted down a sitting volleyball player. Her name is Laura Webster. She had the same surgery as me. And my dad like basically found her family's phone number and then somehow got into contact with her just to talk about specifically her experience in the Paralympics, what it looked like. Because she played stand-up volleyball all the way through college.
Yes.
Her, what she said to me was pretty much, you know, it's hard to make that transition, but once you do, you this world opens up of opportunity, of the love for the game that maybe necessarily hasn't necessarily been there in the same way, and the opportunity to travel the world and to play in college and to do all these things with transitioning to a para sport versus an able-bodied sport. And so that's what kind of sort of convinced me to try it. My parents found a juniors team for wheelchair basketball in my area. So it was the Atlanta team, co-ed, basically 14 and under, you play on your prep team, and then older than that, you play on your varsity team. So it's basically like elementary, middle, and then high school. And I went to a practice, I got in a chair, and I fell in love. And then from there, the rest is history.
You got good quick. Because it wasn't that many years past seventh grade where you're starting to be in that, you're in the, on the development team. And then you rise up in 2019, you're at Worlds.
It was a whirlwind. I remember watching the 2016 women's wheelchair basketball team win gold in Rio and being like, okay, maybe 2024 is my year for that. Maybe Paris. And everybody was kind of thinking maybe Paris. And then I went to a development camp as a sophomore in high school. And Trooper Johnson was like, no, I want you to come to tryouts in January. And then from there, I basically thought he was just having me get my feet wet, you know, get my name in there, get my butt kicked a little to see where I needed to be. And then I ended up making the team in 2018. And from there, I've been on the team ever since. And it just all kind of spiraled so quickly.
Bailey, what was it like in your first experience on the Team USA? Because you said the year before it was a lot of maybe being hit down to be built back up. What did that teach you over that time?
It was information overwhelm. It was being a high schooler in an environment like that where it's adults that have been playing this sport for so long. You're kind of like wide-eyed the whole time. I don't want to mess up. I don't want to do anything wrong. I want them to like me. I want to push hard, but I want to have the approval of all of these people, and I want to get better so that I'm not so far behind. But I had some great people investing in me and investing in my game, some great teammates investing in my game and willing to be patient with me and willing to let me mess up so many times in a row of them saying the exact same thing over and over to me. And they were just so helpful and so supportive and so loving as my teammates, that it was cool to watch my growth over those first few overwhelming years.
Who are some of those teammates?
Rose Hollerman stepped in, Nat Schneider stepped in, Becca Murray, Courtney Ryan, all of those people that are legends of the game before me and that I have had the just blessing of being teammates with. It's just been incredible.
So Worlds happens, you win Worlds, and then it's time to think about college. If you hadn't already, I'm sure you had. What was the recruiting process like, and why University of Alabama?
Yeah, as soon as I started wheelchair basketball, the idea of, oh, I can play in college again, kind of started to open up because my parents both played in college. I thought that dream had died when I lost my leg. With wheelchair basketball, it came back again, and my mom went to Auburn. So the idea of Alabama, the words multiple times came out of my mouth. I will never go to the University of Alabama. And look where we are now, year number 6. But college was definitely in the picture. Like, I wanted to go somewhere. I wanted to play somewhere. And then it was just figuring out that recruitment process. And then, you know, you live your life as a fan of a sport, of a team, and you think that the rival is this dumpy place, and then you come and you're like, oh wait, this is a really great college. I basically knew on my first my first and only visit on Alabama's campus that this is where I needed to be and that this was where I wanted to be.
How about Coach Ryan?
Ryan's awesome. Ryan is one of the sole reasons that my love for the game is still booming and still there, especially in year 6 of college. He's a great coach. He's a great person. He really cares about his athletes a lot. And so it's been a blessing and a pleasure to play under him for as long as I have.
He is one of the best coaches I think that there is in the country across adaptive sports.
Definitely.
He really knows how to get the best out of his athletes. And he's he's just fun to be around.
He is fun to be around.
It's fun to see him in the building.
Definitely.
It really is. And obviously, Coach Zerbs, now you played with her for several seasons. What's it like having her as an assistant coach now?
That was an interesting transition to make just because she's been my teammate since I started, basically.
Your friend?
Yeah, my teammate and my friend. And my roommate for a summer, basically.
Really?
Not really, but we basically quarantined all of the COVID summer together.
Sure.
So we just have spent so much time together. And so having that transition, her being my coach now, it has been interesting because she is my friend and I talk to her like my friend and we spend time together like she's my friend. But then there's this line now with her as my coach just for a couple years.
Yes.
And then she can go back to just being my teammate and friend. But she is, I tell her this, she's grown so much as a coach, so much as a leader, and so much as of somebody that wants to continue to get better in every area that she places herself in, like basketball, but coaching included, that I'm excited to see where she goes because I think she really has a talent and a skill for it, definitely.
Tell me about the Tokyo Paralympics. So COVID quarantining for that, it's not the full Olympic experience like it was in Paris 3 years later, but tell me about Tokyo and what that was like living in that bubble.
I didn't know any differently. It was my first Paralympics, and so I didn't know what to expect, and so I didn't know what I was missing, which I think was good. I think after having been to Paris, I now know what I missed. But, you know, with that being my first experience and with Tokyo being like what I knew, there wasn't as much to miss. I listened to the older players who had been before be like, but we don't have this and we don't have that and this isn't the same. But to me, it was a Paralympic experience and it was incredible. And also, it is one for the history books because
it is.
It was a COVID Paralympic experience, which is something that hopefully won't ever happen again, but also just made things so much different.
It had to be a lot of fun.
It was
very there with athletes from all over the world, the best of what they do. Mm-hmm. The best at what you're one of the best at what you do with women's wheelchair basketball, and to play in front of huge crowds, obviously not that was different. That was different. But at Worlds, you've played in front of huge crowds before up to that point. When you're playing in front of 10,000 fans, how does that make you feel on the court?
That was crazy because in Tokyo we didn't have fans.
Yes.
So to come into the arena in Paris and not even really be able to hear what's happening right in front of you because it's so loud in there, it was really cool. It was overwhelming, but it was like they were feeding into our energy. And it was incredible to then just stand on the court and just like kind of look around at everyone and like the loudness and how many USA fans we had there. You could see our families because we were so everybody.
Was your family there?
I had like 13 people in
Are
my
you
family
serious?
There.
All
my
Paris?
My That's grandparents crazy. Were there. My cousins and my aunt and uncle were there. My immediate family was there. So, and they were all dressed up like an American flag threw up on them. So it was really fun.
What is that like to have your family in the stands and you're playing for Team USA? You're representing the United States.
It's like a dream. It's almost not even reality because you look and you look back on kind of how far you've come and to get to this point and what you've done to get to this point and how hard you've worked. And then you're basically like, I'm finally here. I finally did it. And it's all paying off now. And to have my family there to share that with them was, I think, the best part of the whole thing, just because they're such a integral part of the process and they're the people that see the good, bad, and the ugly in it and are still there and are your biggest fans. And so to have them sharing in that with me, which didn't get to happen in Tokyo, was one of the coolest parts.
Now Coach Ryan is an assistant coach on the Team USA women's national team. Looking ahead Paralympic wise LA is next. I assume your goal would be to play on that team. Now, gold medal seems like the next logical step in terms of your goal, going bronze and silver medalist at this point. What do you want to earn over the rest of your Paralympic career?
The goal has always been a gold medal, and we've been inching towards that. And I think the team, we just – in Tokyo, we were so young. In Paris, we were finally developed. And I think the team makeup may look quite similar in LA, but so we just continue to get to grow, and we're bronze to silver. The next logical step would be to go gold. Yes. So gold in LA is what we're looking towards, but also it's going to take work to get there. And yes, we still have building blocks and steps in the process to get there. And there's time. There's not that much time really, but we got some stuff to work on, but it's time. Like, this team is ready for a gold.
Another 2.5 years of seasoning. I think y'all will be ready.
Putting the finishing touches on.
It'll be so exciting, though. In the United States.
In the U.S.
Representing Team USA. Playing it. It's going to be a big arena. I'm not sure which arena it will be in that L.A. area, but it's going to be big. I can't wait to see it.
Yeah.
I can't wait to see it. That's going to be great. Bringing it back here to Alabama. 5-time national champ. Nothing much, right? I mean, it's not something.
That's something.
5-time national champion. Something. A whole hand worth of national championship rings. What stands out to you the most over your time here at Alabama?
I think what stands out to me the most is we've had a very similar core group over the course of, especially my sophomore through junior year, or sophomore through, I guess, fifth year, senior. It was a very similar group. So getting to grow together and change together and work together it was cool to not have so much turnover and to really get to build. This year, we've got a little bit of a different makeup. My freshman year, we had a little bit of a different makeup. So there is some stuff to change, but overall, we've had a lot of the same members for a long time, which has been cool to watch that grow and to build those relationships and to build that legacy. In Alabama in the past has had some rocky reputations for our program. And so in my freshman year, there was this shift towards this new generation of Alabama basketball and what that looked like. And it's been cool to kind of see how that has grown and cultivated in the time that I've been here.
And you've turned Alabama women's basketball, you and your teammates, and obviously Coach Hines, into a powerhouse, a dynasty, just a dominant program that's obviously won 5 times, has their grip firmly on women's wheelchair basketball here in the United States. And you play with a lot of national team members for United States, different countries. Mm-hmm. What is that experience like, playing against teammates you might even have in the Paralympics?
Yeah, it pushes the level. Our practices are like Team USA practices. They're fast and they're fast paced, and we push each other really hard. And you know, I don't think that much about the fact that my teammates are my rivals when I get to the USA stage, but they are. And they're just my teammates, and I get to push them to be better so that then when they go back to their other teams and we play them, you know, that we're raising the bar as far as just development in the sport as well. But here we get to beat up on each other, and we get to push each other to be better, and we get to raise that level in the collegiate division too, because we have so many national team players that are here and playing and training.
You've used your success, which has garnered a lot of attention, for NIL opportunities. One of my favorites of yours is the Marriott Bonvoy commercial. I've told you about this. I love every time I see it, I watch the whole thing. I don't skip it. Never skip it. It's Bailey. But what has that opportunity been like for you to explore those name, image, and likeness opportunities that maybe weren't there 5-10 years ago?
Yeah, it is interesting. I had the first NIL for like a team paracollegiate sport. My first NIL was with Degree, and I was the only adapted or paracollegiate athlete to be a part of that program. And, you know, I did an NIL empowered program with Meta, which was also cool. Also the only paracollegiate athlete. So there's a lot of trailblazing in this realm that I think we still need to grow as far as that awareness of adapted athletics, specifically in the collegiate space. But it has been really cool to kind of get to pioneer that a little bit and have these opportunities and build that for Team USA as well, because there is this enmeshment of, you know, I am a collegiate athlete, but I'm also a Team USA athlete. What does that look like, and how do I leverage that while I'm still in the college space? But yeah, that Marriott is actually
That's
how you
true,
say
the
it.
Last name. That's,
yes.
I did hear that the other day.
But it was so fun, really fun. The stuff with degree I did years ago was really fun, and then the bits and pieces of other things that I've done in between has been great and a really cool experience, and I hope to do more.
Do you think having the Paralympics in LA in 2028 is an opportunity to increase awareness of adaptive athletics in the United States? It might lead to more of those NIL opportunities.
I definitely think that having the Paralympics in LA will be huge for the USA's footprint in the Paralympic space and in the paracollegiate space. I think Europe, it's very well known. There's professional wheelchair basketball leagues. People know about it. And I think we saw a huge shift with the Paris Paralympics as far as just awareness of the Paralympics in general, especially within the U.S., that I think now once it's on U.S. soil and people are seeing it in person, I just think we're about to see an explosion of awareness. And, you know, just between Tokyo and Paris, coverage time, there was more, we were streamed more, people were going and watching our games, and people knew about the Paralympics. And that was the first time I had ever seen people really hyped about the Paralympics. Paralympic TikTok blew up, people knew. And so I think we're trending in a really good direction for LA.
Now, you're in your final year of your master's here at the University of Alabama in clinical health counseling, and you spoke about counseling and the impact that you want to have in your profession, the impact that it has on individuals at the first annual Whole Athlete Project event that we had at the University Club just a few weeks ago, and it was extremely successful. That project is headed up by our wonderful assistant director of athletics and our director of sports medicine, mm-hmm. Alex Curry, does a tremendous job for our program. Also involved with Team USA mm-hmm. as well. But you spoke very passionately about counseling and mental health. Mm-hmm. What do you want to do with your career professionally?
I would eventually love to work with athletes. I'd love to work in specifically counseling athletes. So maybe a little bit of sports psychology, but more on the counseling private practice side and seeing athletes as a whole human and helping them work through things off the court so that on the court, they're the best that they can be. I think there's so many layers of a person, and if we don't help them as a human first and we don't make sure that they're good off the court, out of the pool, off the field, they're not going to be able to perform. Regardless of how hard they work on their skills, they just won't be able to perform, because you got to take care of your mind like you take Definitely. Care of your body. And so that's where I want to bridge that gap a little bit. And because of my experience in athletics and because of the understanding that I have of how hard it is and how much it takes to get to where I am, and also the work that I've done on my mental performance and my headspace and my game off the court, I know how important it is and I know how beneficial it can be. And so I want to be able to be that for other athletes as well.
Sometimes the toughest opponent in sports is the opponent that's in between your own ears.
It's true. It's true. It's the loudest one, and it's the loudest critic. And so if you can't figure out the tools in order to help there and be strong there, it doesn't matter how hard you work on your physical skills.
I know you're keen on your legacy, and you spoke about it a little bit ago, about your legacy here at Alabama, what you're leaving after your incredible career here. That's still not complete yet. The final chapter has not even been written yet here at the University of Alabama. How do you want to be remembered?
I want to be remembered as a good teammate. I don't care necessarily about my legacy of how good of an athlete I was or how good of a player I was. I want to be remembered as the one that loved my teammates well, that busted my butt when I was on the court, that was really present in their lives and was really supportive of them. And I want them to know that I believe so wholeheartedly in them and them as people, but also them as athletes and their development as athletes, that like, I could care less if you remembered how many points I scored or how well I played, if you knew that I cared about you as a person.
I think that's how you're going to be remembered, Bailey. Just how, that's who you are. That's who you are.
I appreciate that.
That's exactly what people are going to think if they think of Bailey Moody.
I appreciate
Absolutely. I know for your family, faith was a very important role, especially after your diagnosis and going through those difficult, really challenging months, years after that diagnosis. And I've seen situations like that where kids, after a couple of years of living a normal life, or could be even over a decade living a normal life, then they have that accident where they have that diagnosis and it changes their life and their families are torn apart. Faith across the board has been that one source of true connection that I've seen in people's lives. James chapter 1, verses 2 and 3 matter a lot to your family over that time. I read an article. I want to read that, and I want to ask you what it means to you.
Sure thing.
So James chapter 1, verses 2 through 3. Consider it pure joy, my brothers and sisters, whenever you face trials of many kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith produces perseverance. What do those verses mean to you?
I think you see it in the first few words, count it all joy. Joy is not a fleeting emotion. It's different from happiness. It's not dependent on circumstances. And I think if we are able to find joy and choose joy, it doesn't matter what we're going through. And that comes with 1 Thessalonians 5, 16 through 18, praying without ceasing and giving thanks in all circumstances. And, you know, joy is not found inward. It's found in, you know, my hope in Jesus and my relationship with Jesus, but also it is so not dependent on how my day is going or how well of a basketball player I am. And it's so much bigger than just what's going on in the day to day. And having that perspective and knowing where it all matters and where it all lies and where my foundation is built is huge in finding my why, but also recognizing that it's so much bigger than basketball and it's so much bigger than something hard that you're going through in the moment that you're going through it.
Can you apply that to your career as well, especially with counseling?
I'll say it again. It's bigger than basketball. I couldn't care less about, I work really hard, but I don't need to be remembered as that player. I want to be able to invest in people wheelchair basketball is an avenue for that. It's an avenue to get to play the sport that I love, but to also be able to love people well and give back to people younger than me and be able to then be in a field where I'm able to do that every day.
Yeah.
And
how awesome
I'm able
that?
To be in front of a person and be present with them and help them and guide them and just sit with them in what's hard. And that's all because of this and all because of what I'm doing. And also, if I hadn't lost my leg and if I hadn't been through what I went through, I wouldn't be playing wheelchair basketball. I wouldn't have the platform that I have. I wouldn't have these opportunities and I wouldn't be where I am. So I'm thankful for it. And yeah, it was hard. It was really, really hard. But there's just been so many blessings that have come from it.
You're quoted as saying really, really, really hard circumstances can bring about the greatest blessings, like you just said. How did you come to that perspective? How did you get to the point where you lived with that joy and that positivity?
I think, you know, life is hard. And we live in a world that is broken. And with that comes really hard things. But also it's about perspective too. Because, you know, going through that at 10, I thought everything was over. I didn't know if I was going to live. And then if I step back now and look at that bird's eye view of everything, it's just blessing after blessing. It's so much hard. But then if I look back at it now, oh my gosh, I'd do it all again because of where I am and what I get to do. And I think that is where the bring about the biggest blessing thing comes from.
That's very powerful. I can think back to my own life. I had my injury when I was 4 years old. And I would do it all over again. I think it's the second greatest blessing that's ever happened in my life, besides being born into the family I am. But I would do it all again, even just to meet my my closest friends again. I would do it again to meet them because I love them that much. And I wouldn't have met them mm-hmm. without having my spinal cord injury. And it's led us both here.
Yeah.
And it's going to lead us to where we go from here.
Yeah.
I love that perspective because I can empathize with that so much in my own life. Before we go, I'd love you to give whatever advice you can to someone who may be watching this or listening to it and going through a really, really hard circumstance of their own. How can they apply some of the lessons that you've spoke about today and that you've mm-hmm. learned in your life to maybe the situations that they're facing today?
Mm-hmm. We've already kind of talked about it, but sometimes your circumstances are so hard you can't see all the way through it and you can't see anything outside of it. But sometimes the really hard things can bring about the biggest blessings, and oftentimes they do. And maybe it's not in the way that you expected it to or maybe even wanted it to, but in my experience, there's always something beautiful. You just kind of have to look for it. And sometimes those really, really, really hard circumstances bring about those really beautiful things.
Even in the darkness, we're told even in the darkness, God is with us.
Absolutely.
God's with us. And he's closer than ever in those darkest times. We just have to have faith that he's there.
And he Absolutely.
Is. And that's the best part. Bailey, thank you so much for your time today. You are amazing.
Thank you.
And I'm really grateful that you took the time to be with me today. It really means a lot. And
sure
your message is going to inspire a lot of people.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening today. And we'll see you next time on Game On.